This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated June 7th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first story, top of the fold, square one on track with Bank of America vet at the helm. This article is by Lee Weisbecker and is from Durham. In his 25 years as a top executive at Charlotte Bank of America, Doug Bowers supervised thousands of employees and studied financial reports in which the numbers rose into the billions. "I once ran Europe," he says, meaning B of A's European operations. The workforce there was about 3,000. Today, Bowers is entering his third year as CEO of Durham-based Square One Bank. Total assets, $2 billion. Payroll, 220. He admits that he's had to get used to far fewer zeros on the balance sheet he inspects, but he has no complaints. "It had all the pieces I was familiar with, and I love the story." Bowers took up the reins at North Carolina's most specialized lending institution in March 2011 upon the death of founder Richard Casey. It had been Casey's dream to forge a bank that competes nationally with the likes of Santa Clara, California-based Silicon Valley Bank, as the go-to lender for tech and life services startups and venture capital firms. Casey was well on the way to making Square One a well-known quantity on both U.S. coast when he passed away at the age of 63. And now Bowers is moving the ball forward and perfecting the bank's approach. And he's been getting results. Square One will look at growth of 20% to 25% this year as it did in 2012. "And that kind of growth will be out there for us for some time to come," he says. Over the past 18 months alone, Bowers has opened a new lending office in Chicago, created an asset management division that puts clients' deposits into short-term investments, and beefed up the bank's commitment to life sciences lending. Add to that list the successful completion of a growth capital fundraiser that saw Square One pull in more than $21 million. At a time when traditional community banks were finding new cash nearly impossible to obtain, investors were more than willing to continue betting on the Square One model. In fact, in an era of relatively slow growth in the larger economy, says Duke University finance professor Ed Teryakian, the Square One model has been ideal for drawing investor interest, offering them access to high tech and life sciences, two sectors that didn't collapse during the Great Recession. Under that model, the bank works out of a single home office but maintains loan production offices in tech hotspots throughout the country. Austin, Texas, Denver, Colorado, Chevy Chase, Maryland, Washington, D.C., New York City, Boston, and elsewhere. Outside of Durham, which houses 156 staffers, the company has its biggest presence with 17 staffers in California. At most of these far-flung locations, Square One loan writers go toe-to-toe with reps from Silicon Valley Bank, San Jose-based Bridge Bank, and Farmington, Connecticut-based Horizon Technology Finance. It's a small community of competitors, each on the hunt for the entrepreneur with the latest, best idea. "It's a bank that knows its borrowers," says Raleigh-based Raymond James investment banker Bill Wagner. "Square One has been a very interesting bank to watch." Among its latest loan clients are Morrisville-based Advanced Liquid Logic, which develops microfluid laboratory tools, and San Ramon, California-based CellPoint, an online video advertising platform provider. The loans Square One writes are paid back with interest, but also with warrants convertible into common shares in the tech companies. It is these warrants that become like gold if the tech firms catch fire later on down the road. Clients on the Square One loan book are also encouraged to open accounts and make deposits in the bank. That loan book currently is divided 50% among high-tech companies, 30% among life sciences, and 20% in loans to venture capital firms. The secret to it all, Bowers says, is in knowing which startups and which technologies represent the best investments. This business is a bit of a calling, he says. What we do is lend to young companies which have the new ideas and which in the future will be the ones hiring people. It's a fascinating process. Asked if he plots the course of Square One's progress according to a set of specific blueprints with specific benchmarks to hit, Bowers brushes the question aside. I don't focus on size, he says. I focus on growth and the opportunities. Next up is this week's cover story. It's entitled The Builders. While many have been involved, four stand out in sculpting the capital city. This article is by Sugerta Mukherjee, and it's been written in Raleigh. Had it not been for Kid Brewer, the successful Raleigh businessman who went to prison in the mid-1950s for 4 months, Crabtree Valley Mall probably would never have been built. Brewer, an All-American football player at Duke University, got into the development business in the 1960s and owned all of the land at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and Blue Ridge Road. His house was on top of the hill overlooking the future mall site and became to be known as Kids Hill. But his interest at that time was in buying the Sir Walter Raleigh Hotel downtown. Perhaps because of his past legal troubles and his unsuccessful attempt to land a seat at the State Court of Appeals, the hotel's owner, Plaza Associates, fended off Brewer's interest in the early 1970s. Enter C.B. Jones, a former Raleigh mayor and a well-known developer. Jones was interested in buying the Crabtree land, which Brewer was reluctant to sell. So Jones had an idea. He knew people in Raleigh and swiftly managed to buy the Sir Walter Raleigh Hotel that Brewer wanted. He owned it for one day. The next day he went to Brewer and offered him the Raleigh building in exchange for the Crabtree land. Brewer accepted the offer and the mall was built. For CB's son Roddy, age 76, that transaction marked the beginning of two decades of meteoric growth of a small southern city that in the early 1970s was home to fewer than 200,000 people. But by then, another Raleigh son was making a name for himself. Smeads York, son of J.W. Willie York, followed his dad's footsteps in the development world and became the mayor of the city of Oaks. In the early 1970s, the younger York recalls, excuse me, there was a no-growth or at least a slow-growth element on the Raleigh City Council. So some of us got involved and wanted to move the city forward. Even when York became a mayor in 1979, the York's family name was ingrained within the very texture of the community. Willie had built Cameron Village, and when the shopping center opened in 1959, Smeads was an 18-year-old jock ready for prime time at North Carolina State University. At that time, Cameron Village was the largest shopping center in the Triangle. As Willie York and C.B. Jones faded from the scene, the transition of their development companies to their sons was natural, with Roddy taking over Davidson and Jones, and Smeads assuming the helm with York Properties. On the scene were two other individuals who were quietly amassing wealth and building influence. O. Temple Sloan Jr., the son of a successful businessman in the discount store business, was getting seriously interested in real estate by 1970. Sloan's dad had retired after selling the 94-store American Stock Exchange Company, Max Stores, Incorporated, to a convenience store legend himself in this part of the woods, Truby Proctor of Sanford, who, along with his partner, Sam Wernham, built what is today The Pantry, now a publicly traded company worth $300 million. And the younger Sloan proved to be fit for the sometimes rough-and-tumble world of business. Now 74, he built General Parts International into a 3,000 CarQuest-branded store, a $3 billion company with 14,700 employees. As for real estate, he knew how to wheel and deal, and just asked Steve Stroud, a current-day business icon who heads NAI CareAtlantic, one of the largest commercial brokerage firms in the Southeast. Temple was in the top 10 group, Stroud, age 69, says with a laugh. If he bought a property for $1,000, he wanted 10 times that amount. While Jones and York oversee real estate companies built by their fathers, Sloan and Stroud are first-generation investors and builders. But they too have submitted their places in the annals of Raleigh's development. Over the past four decades, these four men have been involved in deals with a collective market value north of $8 billion. That's right, $8 billion. But it was not until the formation of Highwoods Properties in 1972 that the work of Sloan, Jones, and Stroud flourished. A 120-acre lot along Capitol Boulevard at the I-440 Beltline interchange was their target, and Stroud had been working for months to get a handle on how to buy it. Finally, one day he hit upon it. It was right in the path of Raleigh's growth, which was moving northward. Howard Manning, a noted Raleigh lawyer who was representing Sloan, Jones, and Stroud in negotiating for the property, told Stroud that his group could buy the land if they could come up with the money in 24 hours. The price was more than $10 million. Sloan recalls phoning Jones and saying, "Roddy, I think it is time to make that phone call," meaning to their dads. They got the land and began looking for a buyer. Rex Hospital, which had outgrown its small campus on Wade Avenue, was looking and even signed a contract for the land. The trio thought they'd hit a home run. But that deal fell through primarily because Rex's leaders decided the land was too close to Wake Med on Newbern Avenue. "We thought we were done," Sloan recalls. But in the early 1970s, there was a move toward building office complexes around the southeast, and one person was doing a remarkable job on behalf of Coger Company in Atlanta, Ron Gibson. He was leasing out buildings to tenants before they were even built. "We had to talk with him," Jones said. "After the Rex deal collapsed, we made our minds up to build office parks." After Gibson came on board, Highwoods Properties began taking off. Stroud recalls the partners meeting every week with Gibson at the old Farmers Market restaurant off Hodges Street in Raleigh, and Gibson giving them an update on the progress. While reminiscing, Sloan even joked, "With Stroud and Jones as your partners, there's no question. I was the silent one," Stroud laughingly retorted. "I do not remember it that way." Today, Highwoods Properties is a $3 billion real estate investment trust that trades on the New York Stock Exchange. Gibson has retired as president but remains active in real estate. Sloan continues to be the independent chairman of the board. As Raleigh grew, so did the need for retail. And in so many ways, timing played into the hands of these individuals, who essentially had a part in developing most of all of the major retail centers in and around Raleigh between 1960 and 1990. The Yorks built the Cameron Village Shopping Center, Mission Valley Shopping Center, and played a key role in assisting a New Yorker, Ed Richards, in building North Hills Shopping Center before it was demolished to make way for what North Hills is today. The Jones family built Crabtree Valley Mall and, with the Yorks, developed the Cary Village Mall, which later became the Cary Town Center. While Sloan was not involved in any of these projects, Stroud was, and by offering his expertise in evaluating and buying land. Between 1959 and 1972, these projects were serving Triangle residents, and we knew at that time this area was on its way to becoming big, Jones remembers. So why did Raleigh and the Triangle grow so fast over the past 50 years? Almost unanimously, the Big Four's answer is because of IBM's presence in the Research Triangle Park. Stroud says that when IBM decided to move its computer division to RTP in 1965, the ballgame changed. He was working with C. L. Adams & Company, and at that time, when owner Clarence Dams gave Stroud his first big break. "Frankly, we did not know how to deal with all the newcomers coming into this area," Stroud said. In fact, Stroud remembers a running joke at the time. A Raleigh native was anyone who was here before IBM. IBM brought much more than jobs. It brought suppliers and jump-started development all around the airport and helped start the foundation of Sloan's real estate investment portfolio. Not only that, Sloan invested in a cabinet-making plant off US 70, which was primarily to serve IBM. Stroud assembled the land, Jones built it, and Sloan put money into it. But since everyone was fairly new to the game of developing and building, the plant's water supply ran out after 2 weeks. "We had to pump water to the plant off the creek before we could fix the issue," Stroud said, adding, "We did that ourselves." For all their successes, these four builders faced their share of challenges and public relation nightmares. Davidson & Jones was one of the premier real estate developers in the 1980s during the rush to develop commercial properties. But an influx of developers from other states, notably Florida and Texas, forced the region's development to overheat by the decade's end. Anticipating a future development boom, Jones had purchased a large portfolio of raw land. But when the market cooled off in the 1990s, the firm felt the consequences of that decision when it couldn't collect income on empty lots to pay off its loans. The company barely skirted bankruptcy in 1990 when the development boom crashed, and by early 1990, Jones and his investment team were almost $400 million in debt. The company was downsized significantly. But in the end, Jones emerged from the nasty downturn while several others languished. For Sloan Jr., it was less about real estate and more about business. In 2009, when Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis was under fire, Sloan, a Bank of America lead director, was blamed for the bank not having a solid succession plan. Sloan declared that he had a successor list and that the board discussed future plans every month. The following month, May 2009, Sloan resigned from the board. As for General Parts, it was obvious that the company was working to trim the fat from its balance sheet during the recession. In 2006, General Parts employed about 24,500 people. By 2011, that employee base had dropped to 14,000 people. But in that same time frame, General Parts' revenue grew by more than 20%, from $2.4 billion in 2006 to $2.8 billion in 2011. Forbes recently estimated the company's revenue to have reached $3 billion, making it the 146th largest American private company. Stroud came under public criticism when what is now PNC Arena was built beside the North Carolina State University football stadium rather than in the downtown Raleigh, as many advocated. Stroud today concedes that downtown probably would have been a better location, but citing strong sentiment among powerful people at NCSU who wanted the arena adjacent to Carter Finley Stadium, he says it might not have been built at all had it not gone where it is. As for York, his position as mayor brought its own set of challenges during his terms between 1979 and 1983. Slow growth proponents cited his family's business ties to complain about what they saw as runaway development. York was unfettered and spearheaded an aggressive agenda for a city that, he has figured, doubles in population precisely every 22 years. Then there were the personalities involved, all big and confident. Those who know the city's past remember that Willie York and C.B. Jones were not always the best of friends. They were highly competitive. Roddy remembers an incident in which his dad bought land from Willie for $10,000 and was convinced he got a bargain to the point that he bragged about it. Willie found out about that and one day, as Roddy recalls, told him, "Tell your dad I laughed all the way to the bank." The two sons chuckle about that incident even to this day. As Sloan explains, there is always an element of luck involved in the success of a business. But frankly, for Stroud, Jones, Sloan, and York, when one looks at their body of work over the past nearly half century, it's hard to fit in luck. Their journeys, while intertwined in so many ways, came through different paths and personalities. Sloan, a quiet man who listens more than he talks, is assertive in his diction. Once his mind is made up, one can easily sense finality. Stroud, with a booming voice, sounds not unlike a preacher when he talks about Raleigh's history. Jones, with his affable laugh, can draw one into any conversation with his storytelling abilities. And York has the air of a statesman, which, as a former mayor and a tireless community activist, he is. He is careful with his words, respectful of his peers, and encouraging to the new wave of Triangle business leaders who will shepherd the next generation. There's no doubt that there are scores of people in the Triangle, other than these four, who have played a part in the rise of this quaint town of the 1950s into one of the fastest-growing and most progressive metros in the country. Names like A.E. Finley, Carl Hudson, Clarence Adams, Dan Austin, William Cavanaugh all come to mind when speaking of development or downtown's resurgence. In the modern day, much of the heavy lifting has been done by Capital Broadcasting Company owner Jim Goodwin with his American Tobacco Project in Durham, and by Roger Perry with his retail, office, and housing developments in Chapel Hill. To be successful in public policy, to craft the future, one has to look at the past while living in the present. For the Triangle, the future looks bright and is in good hands, but it is far from an overstatement that the people who built much of Raleigh's past, such as Jones, Stroud, Sloan, and York, have helped pave the way for that success. What follows is a brief biography of the four who helped build Raleigh. O. Temple Sloan, Jr., the money man, founder of General Parts International Incorporated and co-founder of Highwood Properties, former lead director of Bank of America Corporation and current board member of Golden Corral Corporation, inducted into the North Carolina Hall of Fame, makes real estate investments under Trail Creek Investments, LLC. Smeeds York, the mayor, president of York Properties and chairman of McDonald York Building Company and York Simpson Underwood Realty, now Prudential York Simpson Underwood. York has overseen the development of Mission Valley, Village Square, Stony Brook, Meadowmont Village, and University Commons shopping centers. He has also overseen two major renovations to Cameron Village Shopping Center, a local landmark built by his father, Willie York. Smeeds served two terms as mayor of Raleigh from 1979 to 1983. Righty Jones, the developer, chairman of Davidson & Jones Construction Company and co-founder of Highwoods Properties, established in 1918, D&J has been at the forefront of Raleigh's commercial and residential development for 95 years. Crabtree Valley Mall in 1972, Highwoods Office Park in 1991, and the Imperial Center Business Park and Sheraton Imperial Hotel in 1999 are among the numerous projects Jones has overseen during his tenure as chairman. D&J's other major projects include the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and Rex Hospital. And finally, Steve Stroud, the broker. Founded NAI Carolantic Realty, one of the area's most prominent and influential real estate brokerage firms, co-founder of Highwoods Properties, was center stage in the building of the Raleigh Entertainment and Sports Arena, now called PNC Arena today. Former chairman of the Centennial Authority, built Arbor's Complex, the One North Commerce Center, Rex Drive Office Complex, Crossroads Complex in Cary, and spearheaded the original assemblage of property around the RDU airport. Next up, Letty's latest idea in education, Apprentices, by Jason DeBrune, from Raleigh. Apprenticeship programs and specific job training are concepts common throughout many European countries, but are scarce across the United States. That's something Kent Misgades wants to change in North Carolina. As the Director of Development at the Thales Academy Group of K-12 private schools in the Triangle, he is the driving force behind the Letty Institute of Technology, or LIT, which provides the e-engineering aspects of the school's STEM curriculum. He is also co-lead on the North Carolina Triangle Apprenticeship Program, NCTAP, what he calls an integral part of LIT's dual-track career preparation program. Lucas Schoenwetter, who was educated in a Swiss apprenticeship program and is now director of human resources at Swiss-owned Bueller Aeroglide in Cary, is working with Misgades to set up an apprenticeship program, which will begin in the summer of 2014. Already they've lined up 15 area manufacturers to take on apprentices. These will be filled by area students who will work for these companies while also taking classes in high school as well as at local community colleges. If all goes according to plan, by the conclusion of an apprenticeship that begins in the senior year of high school and lasts 3 to 4 years, the apprentice would earn a high school diploma, an associate's degree in engineering technology, a journeyman certificate, and already have years of experience within the industry. Ideally, the same companies would then hire the apprentices as full-time workers. It's an idea that's caught the eye of Lou Ebert, president and CEO of the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce. This kind of apprenticeship program strengthens our state's talent and workforce development system by implementing curriculums focused on career and technical education and developing strategies to prepare students for occupations that are in high demand, such as engineering, he wrote in an email. For industries currently challenged with a skills gap, such as manufacturing, this program is very exciting. Ms. Gade says the nation's best industrial program of this kind exists in Charlotte, called Apprenticeship 2000, which works in conjunction with Central Piedmont Community College. The program is a 4-year technical training partnership designed to educate apprentices for Charlotte area industrial partners. Ms. Gades and Sean Ratwetter say they are modeling NCTAP after that program. Thales Academy was founded by Raleigh industrialist Bob Luddy in 2007. It has more than 1,000 students through the ninth grade. On a side note to this article, here's a listing of the companies and their locations. It's briefly entitled, Take My Apprentice, Please. These Triangle area companies that have agreed to participate in the LIT program by taking apprentices are as follows. Superior Tooling in Wake Forest, Captive Air in Raleigh, Bueller Aeroglide in Cary, Amcor Rigid Plastics in Youngsville, Exxon Corporation, Raleigh, Allied Automation, Apex, High Tech Fabrication, Raleigh, Schunk Int in Morrisville, John Deere Turf Care in Willow Spring, Compliant Healthcare Technologies, Holly Springs, Matern USA in Apex, Frudenberg Nonwovens in Durham, Associated Fire Protection in Clayton, Caterpillar in Clayton and Sanford, and Siemens in Wendell. And now, Amanda Hoyle's column that covers commercial and real estate. What's next for Blue Cross Building? The elevated, rhomboid-shaped glass building on U.S. 15501 in Chapel Hill was an architectural marvel when it opened in the mid-1970s as the headquarters for the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. But what will happen to the iconic structure when Blue Cross moves its employees out of the building next year, leaving it vacant? Blue Cross spokesman Lou Borman says the company executives are planning to keep Chapel Hill town leaders informed as they work through their options to sell the 39-acre property at 1830 Fordham Boulevard. The property has a tax value of $35.4 million, according to Orange County records. The Chapel Hill building was a state-of-the-art in 1973, but more expensive to operate in 2013, says Borman. An evaluation of the company's real estate options showed that Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina could save $2.5 million per year in utility and maintenance costs, plus have more flexibility with workspace for employees if the company vacated the Chapel Hill building and renovated two buildings recently acquired at the University Place corporate campus in Durham. Raleigh architect Frank Harmon says he is always dubious of estimates of how much a tenant could save by moving out of an older building. I hate it when people say it can't be used for something else because of it. Well, it can be used for something else. Harmon notes that the 1970s, when the Blue Cross building was designed, was known as the era of bold shapes. They look a little awkward now, just like some of the hairdos of the 70s. Some smaller notes on local business. The small shop buildings within the Hampton Point Shopping Center in Hillsborough, plus land to build another 15,000-square-foot building, has sold for $6 million to Ziff Properties of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. The 38,253-square-foot retail property, located between the Walmart and the Home Depot stores, was built between 2004 and 2007 by Tribeck Properties of Charlotte. Marcus and Millichap represented the seller in the transaction. Also, Irwin Square Plaza, a 10-story office building at 2200 West Main Street in Durham, was sold for $37.5 million to Maryland real estate firm Federal Capital Partners. The selling partners in the 239,000-square-foot building were with National Asset Services Incorporated of Los Angeles. CBRE represented the sellers in the deal. And finally, the Verena Station Retail and Apartment Building in downtown Fuquay-Verena has been sold for $2.8 million to Design Group South, LLC, a real estate investor group that recently relocated from St. Petersburg, Florida, to Holly Springs. The seller was Aikens Properties of Fuquay Arena, which built the nearly 20,000-square-foot brick building in 2006. NAI Carolinic Realty represented Aikens in the transaction. This week's column from Lauren K. Onisorge about biotech, infotech, and entrepreneurship leads with Not Your Granddad's Investment Model. Raleigh startup Ground Floor is trying to change the real estate investment landscape by taking the power away from the banks and opening the process to other 99%. But is the project currently in beta mode and seeking deals a good move for either the founders or for potential investors? To gauge, first you have to talk to the founders, Brian Daly and Nick Bahargava. Daly teamed up with Bahargava at the incubator Groundworks Labs in Durham, fresh off a role as the executive in charge of Republic Wireless and Bandwidth.com in Raleigh. Bahargava, who lobbied for crowdfunding aspects of the Jobs Act in Washington, D.C., was coming off his own startup, the now-defunct Motavi. Daly, who moved to the Triangle from Silicon Valley in 2004 to work with Durham-based Appia, was looking for a disruptive challenge. At Republic Wireless, we built a brand that is challenging the status quo of the wireless industry, he says, referring to a $19.99 subscription plan that connects phones to wireless routers. He left, he explains, because he needed a new industry to shake up. That's when he met Bahargava and talked crowdfunding. The basic idea? To allow retailers and the general public to get higher returns than in savings accounts, specifically by investing in individual real estate projects. We're doing a multi-tenant residential project as our beta, explains Bahargava. The developer is looking to raise a low seven-figure amount of money, so through our web-based platform, the developer is able to solicit money from retail investors. Those investors will be able to invest in the project, so they basically become lenders to the developer. The investment, he says, will be secured by the developer. Investors can receive their return and principal back within 2 years, he says, adding that the rates of return will be anywhere from 4% to 9%. The interest paid would be taxed as regular income. Nellie Shipley, real estate attorney with Womble, Carlisle, Sandridge, and Rice in Raleigh, says the model isn't typical. The accessibility of the plan, the same aspect touted by its founders, could be cause for concern, she notes. This looks like one of the classic causes of the recession. Too many people investing and they don't know what to do if the investment doesn't pay off, she says. You don't get a high rate of return without a high rate of risk. As investors are funding specific projects and not a project pool, there's a heightened risk, she points out. Daly says the investors can collaborate, share information, and interact with the borrower on Ground Floor's online platform. Ground Floor does not underwrite any investments or provide investment advice, he adds. Ground Floor nets fees from borrowers soliciting deals. This week's spotlight is on sports business, and this article is entitled Per Contract, NCSU's PNC Rights Share Cut to $360,000 by Jason DeBrun. North Carolina State University's cut from naming rights revenue for PNC Arena will be reduced by nearly three-quarters under terms of the 20-year agreement that's now entering its second decade in force. 10 years ago, NC State Athletics Department, Gale Force Holdings, which owns the Carolina Hurricanes, and the Centennial Authority, the group that acts as the arena's landlord, hashed out a naming rights deal with RBC Bank. Per the agreement, RBC would pay $4 million annually for 20 years to have its name on the building. When Pittsburgh-based PNC Bank bought RBC Bank, it took over the same contract and changed the name from RBC Center to PNC Arena. The second half of the contract begins this year. Before arriving at the existing agreement, there was a dispute about who actually owned the naming rights. NCSU and Gale Force both wanted to work out their own deal, but agreed that the Centennial Authority, which comprises various government appointees, would own the naming rights, says Clyde Holt, an attorney with Smith Moore Leatherwood in Raleigh. Holt serves as the Centennial Authority's general counsel and has worked on arena matters since before the building opened. The agreement, it was reasoned, would ensure that the arena's interest would always come first. Because the Hurricanes play more home hockey games than the Wolfpack play home basketball games, 41 compared to 15 to 20, the authority decided to give the Hurricanes a larger portion of the naming rights revenue. At the time, NCSU claimed to have already have a naming rights deal worth $10 million in place. To compensate the university, the authority allotted NCSU $1.3 million per year for 10 years to cover the agreement plus interest. For the second half of the contract, NCSU receives between $356,000 and $362,000 and must use that money for improvements at the arena complex. The Hurricanes receive about an 8% bump in the second decade, hovering around the $1.15 million range. The authority sees its portion go from $660,000 to zero. But a new fund called the Capital Reserve Fund comes online and receives about $1.5 million per year. As the name suggests, this fund will be used only for capital projects that will benefit all users. A new scoreboard, new seats, updated bathrooms, for example. Qualifying projects can happen at the entire complex, not just at the arena itself. This Capital Reserve Fund is the secret sauce that will keep the arena up to date in the coming decade, says Holt. Everyone agreed that the building should come first, he says. As part of the contract, PNC Bank received an allotment of up to $800,000 for inventory cost. This essentially means it gets that much in allowance for items such as a suite, which costs $150,000 a season, or floor and ice advertising. The remaining $150,000 to $200,000 goes to Gale Force, which operates the arena during Wolfpack games and practices. Since this was the contracted agreement for the past decade, NCSU has been preparing and budgeting for the shift, says Chris Kingston, the NCSU Executive Senior Associate Director of Athletics. On a side note to this article, there has been a dispute over scheduling dates at PNC Arena, which has been smoldering for nearly a year. Here is a timeline of the events. September 6, 2012. NC State University Athletics Director Debbie Yao and men's basketball coach Mark Gottfried claim scheduling priority. September 24, 2012. Gale Force says NCSU's requirements completely undermine our ability to operate the arena in a first-class manner, quote unquote. October 15, 2012. Centennial Authority Chairman Thomas McCormick points out that the arena serves the entire community and larger region, end quote. January 11, 2013. Hurricanes General Manager Jim Rutherford says Gale Force needs more dates and requests a meeting. January 18, 2013. In a letter to Rutherford, Woodson writes, NC State has no additional flexibility with respect to scheduling, end quote. May 9, 2013. Woodson offers examples of how NCSU has given Gale Force scheduling concessions in the past. May 14, 2013, Rutherford responds to Woodson, arguing that Gale Force needs more dates to schedule games. May 22, 2013, Rutherford says that Gale Force has already had to cancel one event with expected revenue of $170,000. And in a closing article, the bank is not telling how it's handling its refund. Per the naming rights agreement, PNC Bank is entitled to $25,000 per home game anticipated but canceled. Because the NHL lockout canceled 17 home games for the Carolina Hurricanes, PNC is entitled to a refund of $425,000 or could receive some sort of substitute benefit of that value. Marcy Zwiebel, a spokeswoman for PNC, said the bank won't publicly discuss its plan of action. However, the Centennial Authority, which acts as the landlord for the arena and distributes the naming rights revenue, has factored in the reimbursement in its annual budget. Not that $500,000 means that much to the bank. In just the first quarter this year, PNC reported $1 billion in net income. Next up, The Disney Experience? Colleges are all ears. This article is by Michael Smith and is from Charlotte. Mr. Smith writes for the Sports Business Journal, a sister publication to the Triangle Business Journal. The Southeastern Conference, during the recent spring meetings, put together a committee to study the fan experience at football games. Among the things they'll look at are Wi-Fi in and around the stadium, enhanced replays on the video board, and better scheduling. For Jeff James, Vice President and General Manager of the Disney Institute, something was missing. Technology is great, but it will never replace the emotional connection with the fan, James says. We get a lot of guest letters at Disney, and none of them ever point out the technology in Cinderella's castle. They all talk about a human connection they had with a cast member. The Disney Institute has been around for 25 years, sharing its ideas on how to culturally run a business and interact with guests, and much of its growth in recent years has come from working with sports clients, including the NFL. Most of those sports clients have been pro teams, but Disney now sees an emerging business in the college space. In the last few years, Disney has worked with Michigan State, Tennessee, Arizona State, Auburn, and beginning this month, North Carolina. All of the college businesses have been generated by word of mouth from one school to another. The requests from schools generally ask for ways to improve the game day experience, but Disney also works with them on creating a better working environment inside the athletic department. Costs can range from the high five figures into the six figures, depending on how the program is customized. The feedback we've received has been astonishing, says Rocky Harris, Senior Associate Athletic Director at Arizona State. People told us they saw noticeable changes. People who have been here a long time said they've never heard so much positive feedback. Harris joins the staff at Arizona State from Major League Soccer, where fans were like gold. He knew something was culturally amiss when he heard staff members complaining about donor requests. Quote, this guy gives us $50,000 a year and we're actually trying to prevent him from getting a better parking space, Harris says. Customers were thought of as a hindrance. It was such a different mentality than the pros. Arizona State, which was in the midst of an administration change with the promotion of new athletics director Steve Patterson, addressed the lack of customer focus by hiring the Disney Institute in 2012 to train its employees and vendors on creating a better game day atmosphere. No, Mickey didn't replace Sparky as the school mascot, but Disney was central to changing the way employees at Sun Devil Stadium viewed the fans. Disney also worked with ASU's administration on internal relations between senior staff and employees in the department. Disney doesn't establish the measurements for return on investment, but Harris says there have been tangible improvements. Season ticket holders have renewed at a 90% clip, the highest the school has had, and ASU's new ticket sales are up 50% over last year, and donations are $2 million ahead of last year's pace. And now, the small business, called the Produce Box. Fresh from local farmers, this company delivers the goods. This article is by Thompson Wall. From its owner's garage to a sparkling new warehouse, the Produce Box has taken root, packaging and delivering fruits and vegetables and breads to more than 8,000 families in the Triangle, Triad, Burlington, and Wilmington. Courtney Tellefson, founder and owner of the Produce Box, says she remembers struggling to find healthy local produce for her children. The reality of what it looks like to go to the market with children is very different than this rosy picture I had painted for myself, Tellefson says. My daughter's picking strawberries off the ground and my son's running around like a madman. Tellefson decided there had to be an easier way. She sent an email to her neighbors asking if anyone would be interested in a fresh produce door-to-door delivery service and immediately received overwhelming support. Tellefson started delivering boxes of produce from a single farmer to her neighbors in Quail Hollow with her 2- and 4-year-olds in tow. For 2 years, the Produce Box operated out of a 10-by-15 office in a 75-year-old warehouse on Whitaker Mill Road in Raleigh. Tillefson rented 5 refrigerated Big Rig trailers to store the produce, but on May 21st, the produce box celebrated the opening of its new warehouse hub, located 10 minutes outside downtown Raleigh. It has more than 29,000 square feet of storage space and a 4,800 square foot cooler. Richard Reich, Assistant Commissioner for the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, said at the warehouse grand opening that the produce box has struck a balance of innovation with fidelity to local farmers. "It's about providing for a better community, for a better, healthier environment," Reich says. To ensure nothing goes to waste, TPD, the produce box, makes weekly donations to Raleigh's Interfaith Food Shuttle. The company has also partnered with UNC Chapel Hill and Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina to provide more than 80 boxes to local low-income neighborhoods. And in 2012, TPB donated more than $20,000 in farm fund grants to its local business partners for purchasing seed, equipment, and other aid. Now in its sixth year, TPB collects and delivers produce from upwards of 50 North Carolina farmers, making it one of the state's largest produce buyers. The company operates in more than 20 cities in eastern North Carolina and plans to deliver nearly 2 million pounds of produce this year. The produce box's 20-plus sites around the state employ more than 150 stay-at-home moms, dads, and grandparents who drop off fresh produce to customers' doorsteps. Tillefson's homespun delivery service isn't the only one in town. Papa Spud's, owned and operated by Rob Meyer, opened in the same year as the produce box. Since then, 5 other local competitors have entered the produce delivery market. Tillefson says TPB will remain steady with its mission. "We're 100% local, which we are awfully proud of," she says. Besides competition, there are other challenges that must be faced. If inconsistent weather or delayed growing seasons hurt a farmer's crops, Tillefson says, her company will help those farmers by packing their less-than-perfect produce alongside other farmers' successful crops. By doing so, she says she's created a network of farmers able to help sell each other's products, even though most of them have never met. "We balance the needs of the farmer with the needs of the consumer," she says, "so we're not completely consumer-driven, which is very strange in this day and age." This week's Sales Focus is by Greta Schultz. Ms. Schultz is a sales consultant for businesses and entrepreneurs. Grant is a longtime client and friend. He owns a small products company. He asked me to assess and interview a friend of a friend whom he is considering for a sales job. I sent the assessment to Steve, and he completed it quickly. When I looked at it, he scored high in all the areas that would make him good for a service job. But for the type of sales Grant and, frankly, most sales organizations needs, he was not a fit. I spoke to Grant about this, and he said, "Can you talk to him anyway? I think you really like him." That is probably the thing I hear the most from directors and CEOs alike. "But he's really a good guy. Just talk to him." If I had a dollar for every time I heard that and the candidate was not a fit, I would be living on a beach enjoying a margarita. I called Steve and spoke to him for quite a while. Actually, he spoke to me, frankly, at me, for quite a while. Yes, Steve was certainly a nice guy, friendly and outgoing. He had the gift of gab, which is quite the opposite of what I was looking for in a sales professional. What I thought was so funny was that he said he recently took an online career survey, and it said he would be good at sales. He also explained that when he asked people that knew him best, all of them said they thought he was a natural salesperson. That's another quip I hear all the time. The truth about sales is that most people have no idea what makes a good salesperson. The common belief is if you have a good personality and are outgoing and likable, you would be good at sales. Honestly, that is far from the truth. Years ago, and in certain situations, this may have worked. For example, when the economy was rocking and you were selling a product that everyone needed anyway, and prices were fairly consistent and it was just a matter of who to get it from, maybe this would work. Today, we need to be more skilled, more resourceful, and much more consultative to persuade. Here are some things to look for when hiring. Preparation. Professional salespeople don't just rely on a good personality to get the sale. They research the organization and develop good, thought-provoking questions. Next, digging deeper. When professional salespeople get the answers to the questions they are asking, they don't immediately flip into the selling mode. Top sales professionals take the answers to these questions and dig deeper for a fuller understanding before they recommend anything. Also, always know the next step. Professionals know that the sale is nothing without having a clear next step, not just a follow-up call, but a true understanding of what the next step is and when it will occur. And finally, toughness. Ultimately, top sales professionals are tough. Yes, they can be friendly and outgoing, but more importantly, can they stand their ground when the prospect throws them a curveball? Throw them a curveball and find out. I recommend saying something like, "I've interviewed several people that have the same experience as you. Why should I hire you over them?" It's important to put prospective hires in a situation similar to the one they will be in when selling. Put a little pressure on them. Don't sell them on working for your company. Make them sell you and see how they do. That is their job. This week's guest opinion is by Mr. Ross Lampe. Mr. Lampe is the owner of Lampe and Malfris Lumber in Smithfield. This article is entitled "State Certification Process for Timber Industry is Hurting North Carolina Businesses." Personal experience in the timber industry illustrates the misguided nature of certain policies for wood products in North Carolina. My company, Lampe and Malfris, manufactures and sells southern pine lumber. For the last several years, we have not been able to sell or supply lumber to state building and renovation projects. The reason for our getting blocked from these projects is that the state enforces LEED standards for builders and businesses seeking to participate. LEED affects the timber industry as it only awards sourcing credits to wood certified by the Forest Stewardship Council. A minuscule number of Southern Pine lumber companies have received FSC certification in southern states, none of which are headquartered in North Carolina. As a result, the vast majority of businesses that use and supply this type of wood, such as ours, can get shut out of state projects. This occurred over 2 years ago when our company tried to sell our decking for a state project at Tryon Palace, but was denied because our lumber was certified by the Sustainable Forest Initiative rather than by FSC. In the end, the wood used in the decking came from out of state rather than North Carolina forests and businesses. Making FSC a controlling requirement for public projects increases the likelihood that buildings constructed with taxpayer dollars will use materials imported from areas outside North Carolina. This is likely outcome results from the fact that FSC recognizes only 47,000 acres of forest in North Carolina. Combined competing programs such as the American Tree Farm System and SFI certify nearly 30 times more property here. By excluding lumber from ATFS and SFI certified lands and businesses, governments force builders to look somewhere else for their materials, and that is what they've been doing. Furthermore, when you artificially limit the supply of wood that can be used in a project, its price inevitably rises. Surveys in different markets show FSC-certified timber costing 15% to 20% more than other types of lumber. Why is the state paying more than necessary for lumber to benefit out-of-state businesses? While the previous administration in Raleigh failed to heed the objections to LEED, a number of politicians are speaking up. At the federal level last year, U.S. Representatives Walter Jones, Virginia Fox, and Mike McIntyre criticized LEED for erecting artificial and subsequently irresponsible barriers to products derived from responsibly managed forests and called for changes to its framework. Even more important than pressing, House Bill 628 makes its way to the Assembly floor this week. It would mandate that building codes for state projects award certification credits equally to forest products certified under SFI, ATFS, and FSC. This measure provides immense relief to manufacturers, tree farmers, foresters, and suppliers throughout the state. Leveling the playing field for state businesses expands their customer base and increases commerce within our borders. The measure would also increase competition in the certification market and end up improving the quality of timber in our buildings. Similar steps have already been taken or are underway in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Florida, and Maine, where businesses experience similar issues under a LEAD framework. Hopefully, our elected leadership moves in the same direction for the benefit of our economy, small businesses, family farmers, the workers in the timber industry, and the taxpayer. The McDonnell York Building Company in Raleigh has added another title to President Heather Denny's resume, Chief Executive Officer. Denny says the title change does not mean that company co-founder Jack McDonald is retiring. McDonald has held the title of CEO since merging his company with York Construction Company, led by Smeeds York, in 1993. He and Smeeds felt that the title best described my role in running the day-to-day company operations and holding the top executive position in the company, says Denny, who was promoted to president of the company in 2010. Jack will remain active, working with me on high-level strategy, she says. And York remains chairman of the company's board of directors. People still market with faxes? Really? Which is worse, a class action lawsuit or a mountain of unsolicited faxes? Triangle Business Journal doesn't have an opinion, but businesses do. And it looks like the North Carolina Court of Appeals does too, at least in one particular case that's been bouncing around since 2004. In yet another round of the case, this one on June 4, the appellate court turned back an attempt by Durham area resident Jonathan Blitz to establish a class of nearly 1,000 local plaintiffs to sue two restaurants on Hillendale Road north of downtown for allegedly unsolicited faxed advertisements. In a 3-0 ruling, the court said Blitz hasn't shown that any of the faxes to the other 980 would-be plaintiffs were unsolicited. The restaurant's owner, Aegean Incorporated, has converted them to a single restaurant, the Blue Olive. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at TriangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.